This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It's the last week before Christmas, and this week the Democratic candidates debated for the last time in 2019. I'd say this was the liveliest debate so far, helped by there being only seven candidates on stage, including, for some reason, Tom Steyer. We're going to talk about all the winners and losers from the debate and what we learned in a moment, but first, impeachment. Donald Trump is officially the third president of the United States to be impeached. The voting was along almost exactly the same lines as the vote a few weeks ago to open the impeachment inquiry. All the Republicans voted no, and very nearly all of the Democrats voted yes. One of the Democrats in opposition, New Jersey Congressman Jeff Van Drew, is becoming a Republican. And Tulsi Gabbard, for whatever reason, voted present. Now let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined by Rich Lowry, editor of National Review on the right. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig of the New York Times. Congratulations, Elizabeth.
Thanks, Josh.
And our special guest this week is Gustavo Arellano, who is a KCRW contributor and features writer at the Los Angeles Times. Hello, everyone.
Hola, Josh.
Good to be here.
Hey, Josh.
So, Rich, here is something that the New York Times reported on Thursday. They said, quote, "For Mr. Trump, the day after impeachment found him still a little shell-shocked, according to people close to him. Despite the clear momentum behind impeachment among Democrats in recent weeks, some of Mr. Trump's advisors tried to convince him and themselves that Speaker Nancy Pelosi did not have the votes and might not even bring the articles of impeachment to the floor, despite warnings from the White House Director of Legislative Affairs, Eric Euland, that the votes were there," unquote. Rich, do you buy this, that the president was actually surprised this happened?
Might have been. We talked a couple weeks ago. This was a fantasy. Maybe when Pelosi first said they're opening an impeachment inquiry, you could have seen it flaring out and the votes not being there. But the votes were there. A tremendous tactical victory for Pelosi. We'll see whether it's a strategic victory or strategic mistake or something in between. But I think part of the calculation that pushed all the moderates over to voting for impeachment was the experience of Jeff Van Drew, this relatively moderate Democrat from New Jersey who voted against the inquiry and saw a catastrophic collapse in his support among fellow Democrats. And I think moderates looked at that and figured, well, if we're going to win any election, we need to have the support of our own party and we can worry about swing voters and any Republicans we have to win later. But the first order concern is being with our party on what's become a really important sign of loyalty.
Liz, I don't think I've seen a lot of people besides maybe the president talking themselves into the idea that impeachment maybe wasn't going to happen. But I have seen a lot of people talking themselves into the idea that this has backfired on Democrats politically. Certainly you're hearing that from some Republicans. I'm sensing a little bit of nervousness about that even from Democrats themselves. I'm not entirely sure why. I don't think that's in the data. I mean, the polling has been really pretty flat since the opening of the inquiry. You can make an argument that maybe the numbers have shifted a little bit against Democrats, but not a lot. And this impeachment is way more popular than the 1998 impeachment of Bill Clinton ever was.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of speculation that this has been a political disaster for Democrats. But as you point out, most of it is coming from the right. And I think that it's a wishful thinking measure on their behalf. They hope that this will backfire on Democrats. I think there's still room for Democrats to kind of make a hash of it. If for instance, they decide not to send it to the Senate or something like that, I can see people getting a little annoyed. But so far, I think Democrats have played it pretty straight, and it doesn't appear to have hurt them in any way.
The flip side of that, though, is that there hasn't been any snowballing public sentiment in favor of impeachment or removal like you saw with Richard Nixon and Gustavo. I mean, we'll talk more about the debate in a moment. But the opening question of the debate to the candidates was basically, how do you change people's minds about impeachment? What can or should Democrats be doing to change public opinion on this? And I guess the question is, you know, is there something that they should be doing that they're not doing? Is this, you know, is it a failure that the poll numbers haven't increased for impeachment? Or was this just sort of inevitable?
It was inevitable. It's impossible at this point in this country to get anyone to think that their side is not wrong and the other side might possibly be right. I mean, we were talking earlier about hope. There was hope that maybe some Republicans might vote for impeachment. That didn't happen. Now there's some hope that maybe some of the more moderate senators might vote for impeachment. That's definitely not going to happen, especially when Mitch McConnell is saying, no, I am going to be following this purely partisan. I'm going to follow orders from the White House and himself as the Senate leader and the rest of the party. They're going to look at all these moderates who might have thought like, hey, like people like Mitt Romney, the senator from Maine, who have in the past questioned Trump's scruples. Now there's no hope at all. And definitely all the Democrats, they're all going to vote for impeachment in the Senate as well. So no one's mind's going to change about this. I think at the end, what impeachment does is add fuel to each person's fire, each party's fire. The Democrats are going to say, look, we went after Trump. This is the person we've been trying to get out of the office for 4 years. And Trump and the Republicans are going to say, look, it was always a witch hunt. It was always a witch hunt. They never want to listen to reason. So you have to stick with us.
Rich, I'm wondering your perspective on that, because you preside over National Review, which has quite a bit more diversity of opinion about impeachment than most elements of the conservative movement. Your colleague Ramesh Panuru had a piece yesterday about the four hurdles that you have to cross for impeachment to be justified. He says that this does cross all four hurdles. He says Trump's Ukraine misadventure, you could see it as a lapse of judgment if he showed any repentance or understanding of what he had done, but instead it looks like a window into his tendencies that are incompatible with performing the functions of the office, unquote. So obviously that's not everyone at your magazine. There's a lot of people on the other side of it. To the extent that there is an argument within the conservative movement, it's sort of being had where you are. So what do you make of that diversity of opinion on the conservative side?
Well, yeah, so you're right. To the extent there's diversity of opinion, it's among writers and scribblers, National Review and some other places. And Ramesh's argument is just the once you've established the intention of pushing the Ukrainians to do these investigations in order to hurt Joe Biden, that's just an intolerable offense and one that qualifies as impeachable under the founders' vision. I think what Ramesh says is kind of the prudential argument against impeachment is the strongest, and that's where I think his argument falls down. I don't think this would actually be healthy for our polity or a good thing if Trump were actually impeached and removed. And then there's a practical matter, which Ramesh concedes, that you're not going to remove when the country is evenly divided. And I was just reminded this week that if you go back the prior, obviously very small sample size, prior to Senate trials of impeached presidents, no member of a president's own party has ever voted to convict. There were just 9 Democrats at the time when Andrew Johnson was impeached. No Democrat, obviously, in the 90s voted to impeach Bill Clinton. And it's very likely that no Senate Republican is going to vote this time. So it just goes to, I think we've now established beyond a doubt that partisan impeachments really don't get you anything. And they just act as votes of censure with lots of bells and whistles.
I mean, to Rich's point there about you, there's never been a vote crossing party lines in the Senate on removal of a president. Liz, you mentioned this gambit that House Democrats seem to be at least toying with, which is to say you had Lawrence Tribe from Harvard Law School and various other people saying, the Senate's not going to hold a fair trial. They're not going to call witnesses that they should. Mitch McConnell has explicitly expressed that he is not an impartial juror, even though the Senate rules require them to take an oath to administer impartial justice when they're sworn in as the jury for this trial. And so they're saying don't send the articles of impeachment up to the Senate until the Senate agrees to do something different. And I fail to understand what the strategy is here in as much as, if the Republicans didn't want this impeachment, if the threat is we're not going to let you try the president for these charges, I would think the response is just, OK, fine. So, I understand why that situation is frustrating. I don't understand the idea that this is something that does anything about that.
No, I don't see that. I don't see that being a useful approach either. I mean, like you said, the threat would be unless you agree to hold an impartial trial, we're not going to ask you to hold a trial whatsoever. And I think that would be relying on the American people to get frustrated with the Republicans for not agreeing to hold a fair trial. But I think that in reality, it would probably just result in people being frustrated with the Democrats going on and on and on about how they can't have a trial when, in fact, they're the ones not sending the charges on to the Senate. So I think that's a context where you could have a pretty serious backlash against Democrats over impeachment. And I don't see any sign that Pelosi is actually going to do that. Like I said, it's just been floated by a few characters. And I hope that this doesn't persuade her. But I do think that could be a real disaster if they decide to go in that direction.
Congress is obviously going on vacation now. So the difference between sending the articles of impeachment immediately after the vote and sending them on, January 3rd or whatever, I think is not very material. The question is what Pelosi is going to do in January when they get back. Gustavo, does this idea of withholding the articles make sense to you?
It does, because what Pelosi's doing is trying to trigger the Republicans to do exactly what McConnell did, which is openly, explicitly say, I don't care about impartiality. I'm with the president. I am with the GOP. Whether it's going to work or not, I don't know. But I mean, look, when she comes back, when all the Congress comes back in January, conceivably, she's going to say, okay, here's your articles of impeachment. But over those 2 weeks, she allows it's almost like she wants Trump and she wants other Republicans to just trash them as being nonpartisan when Pelosi's saying, hey, look, I have every right to do so. I'm not following party lines. The Republicans themselves have said they're not going to give us the articles of impeachment a fair trial. So let them flail. Let them flail in the wind. And so far, Pelosi's seems to have been very, very smart and deliberate in what she's done with impeachment, especially after years of saying, I don't know if I want to go down this line. She seems like the voice of reason and on top of everyone there on Capitol Hill.
I agree that she's been true to this point, but this one just is a real head scratcher. I mean, the entire line of defense in the House by Republicans has basically been to muck up the process and make it seem really messy. And here she's doing this herself. And there's now a legal debate on the center left about whether Trump's been impeached or not, and whether he's really impeached unless the articles are forwarded to the Senate. So I can't believe that she will extend this any further beyond when they get back January. She has no leverage whatsoever over what Mitch McConnell is going to do. And it cuts against their argument over the last month that it was desperately important to do this urgently, or the 2020 election will be stolen again. And here she is saying, in effect, no, you know, we can take our sweet time.
What do we make of this oath that senators take? To Rich's point about, you know, never votes in the Senate crossing party lines on removal of a president. Is Mitch McConnell just saying out loud what's really true for all senators on both sides of the aisle, which is that they are not impartial arbiters? And indeed, how could they be impartial arbiters? So should we change this oath? It seems fantastical to me to expect partisan senators considering the removal of a president, either their own party or the opposite party, they can strive to be fair. But I think the idea that they could be impartial is just implausible.
Yeah. I mean, I think that for liberalism to succeed, for a liberal democracy to succeed, you have to have at least some people who are actually concerned with procedural neutrality, at least. But I think that in practice, we can see that there are very few of those people. They're few and far between, and they typically encounter a lot of pressure from external forces, including members of their own constituencies. I think that it's concerning that it's almost impossible to find a neutral arbiter of justice or procedure, because those people tend to be pretty essential for the success of systems like ours. You know, theoretically, for instance, Supreme Court justices are that, but we know, as a matter of fact, they're not. They're also partisan, or at least very ideologically predictable. If you want to change the oath, I think that would at least make it clearer what's going on. But I don't think it would resolve a fundamental problem we have.
It's like objectivity in journalism. Everyone knows that reporters have biases, but I always tell my students, never let your bias get in the way of a good story, like set them aside. So yes, politicians, senators, they have to state whether they're Democrat or Republican or independent. But the hope is in a democracy that, yeah, you just set that aside and you really see the facts for what they are. So, hey, like I would hope politicians act a little bit more like journalists and just let their biases get in the way, or get out of the way, or put the biases out of the way.
Let's take a break. I'll be back with Rich Lowry of National Review, Elizabeth Brunig of The New York Times, and Gustavo Arellano of The Los Angeles Times to talk about the debate. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
What do you think? Share your thoughts on today's show on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. And download the KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, columnist at The New York Times. And our special guest is Gustavo Arellano, features writer at The Los Angeles Times. PBS and Politico hosted a Democratic presidential debate on Thursday at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles. I thought this was easily the most interesting and best moderated debate of the primary so far. Of course, it helped that there were only 7 candidates on stage. Gustavo, what did you take away from this debate?
It was long, 2.5 hours. Like at the end, I was just zoning out. But that said, it moved pretty crisply. There was a lot of talking by everyone. There was not one candidate who dominated the entire conversation. Although Tom Steyer, of course, yeah, why was he there at this point? And I think everyone played to what they were supposed to do, at least internally. I was trying to think of a winner. I would have said Bernie Sanders would have been the winner because I actually thought he had a really good sense of humor and self-effacing about himself. But his problem was whatever the question was, he would not answer it and then go back to one of his pet causes, like climate change or economic equality. As a listener, I just wanted him to actually answer the question. And Andrew Yang, he was the other one where I don't know if he actually thinks he's going to be president, although he says so, but he definitely played up to whatever Andrew Yang's supposed to be, like some guy who's thinking about the future, some guy who wants to give his freedom derivatives, and someone who has a very funny, droll, bro-y sense of humor.
Liz, I mean, I think the consensus on the web was that all or at least most of these candidates had a pretty good night, but obviously not everyone can win a debate. This is a zero-sum game. Only one of these people is going to be the Democratic nominee.
Yeah, I mean, and you did see more clash than I think you typically see, probably because the stage was a little bit smaller this time. I thought Bernie did pretty well. I mean, one thing about Bernie is that, you know, you could lay building foundations by the exacting identicalness of his positions over time. And that includes his debate performances and his public performances. Bernie is on message. He always is. And that's because he believes that a lot of serious issues in society are outgrowths of these underlying problems that he is talking about. So I think that's you know, predictable, and I think that Bernie is predictable is a good thing about him, and is something that a lot of Bernie fans actually seem to appreciate about him. I think the clash between Warren and Buttigieg was pretty spectacular. Sparks really flew there. He asked if she could pass her own purity test in terms of donors. Could he accept a donation from her? For example, if he couldn't be in a room with millionaires, he couldn't be in a room with Elizabeth Warren. That was a pretty serious attack. But then later on in the debate, Klobuchar came back at Buttigieg and told him to effectively respect his elders, which seemed to shame him a little bit. So I think it was a very, very active and energized debate.
Rich, what were your highlights?
Yeah, I don't have much to add to the conventional wisdom. I think Joe Biden was indeed, as a lot of people think, the best he's been in any of these forums, relatively loose, entirely cogent, kind of funny. A moving answer with a stupid question at the end. There always has to be some stupid question at the end. And it was like, what would you ask forgiveness for? Or what gift would you give other candidates? And Biden hit on what just is one of his great strengths as a candidate, just his ability to talk about grief. And he also brought up, which he's never talked about before that I'm aware of, his struggles with the stutter and how people who have a stuttering problem come to him for encouragement and advice. So really good night for Biden. And obviously, you know, when you're sitting on top of most of the polls, a good night is cements his status as a front runner. Pete Buttigieg, I thought he won hands down the exchange with Elizabeth Warren, then probably lost the exchange with Amy Klobuchar. There's just not a great answer to being a mayor of a small city in Indiana in terms of the experience. And just I increasingly find him annoying just because every answer is so perfect. And there only seems to be like one mode to him. Amy Klobuchar, I don't know what it is. Maybe just not hanging on at the extreme edge of the stage among 10 candidates, but she made much more of an impression. And Andrew Yang, although I've been at times annoyed with him and I reject the central cause of his campaign, the idea that automation is going to cause an enormous economic and social crisis, he's a thinking person, you know, and he surprises you and has unusual idiosyncratic answers and also a sense of humor. So all in all, I thought it was a good debate and the best night for Joe Biden.
Yeah, I broadly agree with what Rich had to say there. Andrew Yang has even been growing on me, and I've complained a lot about him before. Now, I don't think he should be president. I don't think he's going to be president. But I increasingly see him as someone who could be like Secretary of Commerce in a Democratic administration, which would be a pretty good return on this long shot presidential campaign that he has run in and overperformed expectations. I thought it was, as everyone's been saying, Joe Biden's best debate so far of the campaign. And, you know, since the previous much more lackluster debate performances were enough to keep him in the lead, I have to think that that is a good thing for him to put in a genuinely good debate performance. And I also thought Amy had a really strong night, and I actually want to play some of that sound from her fight with Pete Buttigieg over their respective experience.
If you want to talk about the capacity to win, try putting together a coalition to bring you back to office with 80% of the vote as a gay dude in Mike Pence's Indiana.
If you had won in Indiana, that would be one thing. You tried and you lost by 20 points.
It was actually closer to 25 points. Buttigieg made a statewide run for state treasurer before being elected mayor in South Bend, which is a strongly Democratic city. You know, I thought Klobuchar really had the best of this exchange in a way that is important because it's clear that electability is so important in the minds of so many Democratic primary voters, and you have different cases for it with different candidates. With Bernie, it's the idea that you're going to bring out marginally attached voters, you're going to build a movement that motivates people and turns them out. With candidates like Joe Biden or with Mayor Pete, the idea is supposed to be that they are more appealing across a broader section of the electorate, better able to win swing voters, to bring Obama-Trump voters back in the Democratic fold. And I think Senator Klobuchar has a really strong argument that if you want to look at people's electoral records and who's actually done that in the past, she has by far a better record than anyone else with that, that her performances in Minnesota, which is close to being a swing state, she outperforms typical Democratic candidates by something like 10 points, you know, even more so than Joe Biden, who represented a Democratic-leaning state, who was a vice presidential candidate with the political phenom of Barack Obama. It's really Klobuchar who has the deepest record in this field of actually overperforming. So if Democrats are nervous about needing someone who would overperform, I think she has a really strong case that's her. I don't know. Liz, what did you make of this performance?
I mean, I thought she did really well. I mean, speaking of people who oddly grow on you, I mean, I think Andrew Yang seems like a really cool guy, and I have liked him personally since the beginning. Klobuchar has really grown on me just because she has such a bad attitude. I really appreciate that. I think that although she tries to kind of play it straight and professional, you can see that she's just annoyed with a lot of the stuff going on the stage. That's pretty clear, and it clocks with stories about her behind the scenes. I think that's kind of endearing. Still don't support her candidacy, but I thought she had a great night, especially because, you know, like a lot of people on the stage last night, she just let more of herself come out, more of her personality shine through. Her personality is probably a little bit intimidating, a little bit sardonic. I appreciate that. She even made a remark about a side of her that frightens her staff. And I think that, you know, that was playing to a strength of hers, which is that she seems kind of no-nonsense, even though she goes for the Midwest nice thing. Bernie also had a similar night in terms of letting more of his entertaining, hammy side out on the stage. And I think that's a good sign from this field.
Yeah, I mean, Gustavo, I feel like a thing there is that people can tell when you're being fake, and that, you know, if there's an aspect of you and people have differing opinions on it, you're usually better off leaning into it than trying to be something you're not. I think this was a problem for Kamala's candidacy, and I think we saw Amy opening up with that. I think we've seen that with some other people in the field as well.
Yeah, the Buttigieg for me just sounds so, like Rich said, sounds so perfect, so canned. He tried to pass himself off as unflappable when you could tell all the attacks against him, even though he knew they were coming, they were really getting to him. Klobuchar, like, I had never really paid attention to her. I think she's trying to put herself right at the center between Elizabeth Warren. For people who think Elizabeth Warren's too left, that they should go for Amy. And for people who don't like Buttigieg for whatever reason, they should also go for Amy. What I appreciate most about Amy is that she just went with herself. A lot of her jokes just fell flat. A lot of her attempts at humor, maybe it's Minnesota nice humor, is just not working, but she didn't care. She just went through it and she just came ready to fight, and she definitely delivered. And yeah, same thing with Bernie. He was really channeling his inner Larry David with a lot of his, there was even the part, oh geez, like he almost tried to cast himself as, what did he say? Like, some sort of Christ joke or Jesus joke. And I was laughing at that one.
I think one interesting dynamic though, Josh, you've talked in the past about how people might be discounting Biden when the national polls just indicate he's the front runner. He's the guy you have to take down, in a similar way that people are discounting Trump's polling in 2015 and 2016. So it is a little odd. And I know Pete Buttigieg is leading narrowly, and I won a lot of polls now, so he's the front runner in the first contest. But it's just, it's weird how people are piling on him and kind of giving Joe Biden, you know, a free pass, who is the front runner, who doesn't necessarily have to win Iowa, but could still win Iowa. And if he does, everyone's done. He's just probably just going to sweep to the nomination at that point. So you have this dynamic you had in the Republican primary where a lot of people were attacking each other on the theory they'd be, you know, dominate this lane or be the last one standing against Trump. And sometimes you just need to take the top dog down, or all your machinations about which lane you're going to dominate and who you're going to get ahead of in your particular lane comes to nothing.
Yeah, it's interesting, Rich, because I think the one candidate who got what you're getting at there is Bernie Sanders, who was the one who really did tangle with Joe Biden. He tangled with him on foreign policy, tangled with him on health care. I want to play some sound from some of the foreign policy conversation, which I thought was especially good in this debate. Here's Joe Biden responding to some Washington Post reporting about progress in the war in Afghanistan being consistently overstated, including under the Obama administration. What does he say about how they surged these troops and didn't get the results that they were trying to communicate that they did?
What do you say
to that? Since 2009, go back and look. I was on the opposite side of that with the Pentagon. The only reason I can speak to it now is because it's been published. It's been published thoroughly. I'm the guy from the beginning who argued that it was a big, big mistake to surge forces to Afghanistan, period. We should not have done it. And I argued against it constantly.
What do you make of that response? I'll open that up to all of you, because my understanding is that that is true, that he was an internal critic of this policy, but he's built so much of his campaign on basically taking a significant amount of credit for the accomplishments of the Obama administration. So it's a little awkward to say, oh, this one, I told him they shouldn't have done that.
I think that people can respect that he was an internal critic while questioning why he wasn't a more vocal public critic. Right. When people are doubting a policy, or when people are looking for signals as to whether a policy is going to be useful, unfortunately, a lot of that information comes from the government itself. So if Biden was internally criticizing it, that's good. He was correct. But he wasn't being open about it publicly. And I think that makes people feel like they can't really trust him on this. Is he going to be honest with the American people when there are bad policies in play in his hypothetical presidency? Or is he just going to be a quiet internal critic while leaving the American people in the dark? And then I also think it sits fairly awkwardly with his structuring of himself as Barack Obama's best friend and natural successor.
Yeah, Gustavo, also when Bernie was responding to this, he pointed out, you know, well, you may have been right about the Afghanistan surge, but you voted to send us into Iraq in the Bush administration, which I've been sort of surprised that there hasn't been more foreign policy conversation in this campaign, especially given how important that was, say, for Barack Obama's campaign in 2008 against Hillary Clinton.
I think people are just so exhausted about anything that politicians say about the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. People admit now it was a colossal mistake. It was a colossal error, and it cost the United States trillions and trillions of dollars. And Biden, he should have just said, we were wrong. Our administration was wrong. I don't think at this point it would have cost him anything with Obama or the Democrats. But to say, yeah, I was against it before, quietly, and now publicly I could say that, that doesn't win him any points with anyone. And frankly, it does open him up to more criticism.
Rich, one of the other big international relations aspects of this debate was a conversation about the USMCA, the trade deal that is moving through Congress, the renegotiation of NAFTA. And there was basically a question to Bernie Sanders about, you know, they've gotten the AFL-CIO on board. Nancy Pelosi has signed off on this. Do you support this agreement? And his answer was basically no. Amy Klobuchar said that she did favor it. Biden also issued a statement after the debate saying that he favored it. I thought this was interesting in that, you know, that this has been one of President Trump's few bipartisan successes, I think in part because it doesn't change the NAFTA agreement that much. But it's interesting to me that you still have Sanders out there staking out a different position.
Yeah, well, and much of the revision was with an eye to winning over more labor-oriented Democrats. And it's clear that Bernie's just not gettable, I think, any realistic version of an agreement with Mexico, free trade agreement with Mexico and Canada, he would just oppose. But Klobuchar says she would support it and use as a shield Sherrod Brown, who the Democratic senator from Ohio has a long history of opposing these trade agreements, who apparently is going to support this one, which just goes to how Trump gave Democrats a lot of what they have spent a couple decades saying that these agreements need, which is more, especially more labor standards. With regard to these foreign countries.
Liz, who is Bernie speaking to when he says that? I mean, because there's been such movement in public opinion polling about trade agreements among Democrats. I mean, I'm sure some of it is thermostatic. If Donald Trump is against it, we're going to be for it. So Democrats have come around to the view that trade agreements are broadly a good thing with foreign countries. Is there still a market for this sort of – for this protectionism that rejects even an agreement that the AFL-CIO has signed off on because of the labor standards in it?
I do think so. I mean, I think you're dealing with the far left flank of the party at that point. I don't think that's any mystery when it comes to who Bernie is talking to and who he imagines to be his core constituency. But I think more importantly, you know, it has the effect of calling out Trump for something that he participated in. Democrats in Congress appear to be looking to agree with Trump on something, anything, to kind of escape this do-nothing Democrats moniker he's put on them. So, I mean, I think it's respectable to come out and say, actually, you know, agreements that don't have acceptable labor standards are still bad. And I understand that there need to be some kind of agreements in place, but they need to be ones that are favorable to workers. I do think there is an audience for that. Although, I mean, admittedly, it's likely a small core constituency Bernie's hoping to energize.
Yeah, obviously Bernie was going not just to the far left, but also Latinos. It's interesting because NAFTA, the two biggest groups are opposing NAFTA, were the H. Ross Perot side, but also Latinos who were saying, especially in Mexico, you're going to destroy the Mexican economy. That's exactly what happened over the past 25 years. The reason we've had such a surge of migration from Mexico was specifically because of NAFTA. Bernie knows that history. He also knows that his young Latino supporters know that history. So that's exactly who he was talking to.
Is that right, though? I mean, we've seen a decline in Mexican immigration to the U.S. over that period. And a reason for that is that the gap in terms of economic output between the U.S. and Mexico has shrunk, in part because of business that NAFTA has brought into Mexico.
That's only in the past 5 to 10 years. But you had that humongous devaluation of the peso in 1994. Everything, like you talk to any Chicano studies scholars, they'll all point to NAFTA. NAFTA being the main reason for pushing Mexicans not just out of the countryside, but into places like Juarez. Once those jobs left to other markets, and they were not going to go back home. They weren't going to go back to the farm. They were going to go back into the United States, or going to the United States.
Let's take a break. I'll be back with Liz Bruning of the New York Times, Rich Lowry of National Review, and Gustavo Arellano of KCRW in the Los Angeles Times to talk more about the debate. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Join the conversation on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and other great shows at kcrw.com/podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, columnist at The Washington Post. And our special guest today is Gustavo Arellano, features writer at The Los Angeles Times. So we can't really talk about this debate without talking about the wine cave, because it was talked about a lot. This is where Pete Buttigieg had a presidential fundraiser in Napa Valley, this cave at the Hall Winery that apparently had a bunch of crystals in it and fancy wine. And it was basically used as a metaphor for the high-dollar fundraising that's happened in this campaign. And of course, I should note, as I have previously, that my husband is a professional political fundraiser, and the Buttigieg campaign has been a client of his in this campaign. And so this exchange, we talked earlier about the other Pete versus Amy Klobuchar exchange, which I think Amy won pretty convincingly. This one was sort of three-way, with Elizabeth Warren basically saying, I don't do these high-dollar fundraisers, so people aren't going to be able to call me up and have me be beholden to them. I'm only beholden to the voters. And Pete's response was basically, you know, Donald Trump has hundreds of millions of dollars. I'm not going to leave money on the table that we could use to be fighting him. And other Democrats don't. This is how money is raised for Senate campaigns, for the House majority reelect. And is also how Elizabeth Warren was raising money for her own Senate campaign, which she then transferred about $10 million to fund her presidential campaign. So even she has been relying on this sort of fundraising. And so, Gustavo, what did you make of how that exchange landed?
He did well on that. I actually, it's easy to make fun of Buttigieg for this. It's easy to just mention wine caves on Twitter. I'm seeing all sorts of people talking about wine caves in their districts or whatnot. But Pete has to make his money. And all of these other candidates are, no one's going to deny or no one's going to say, no, you can't give any money to me. I think the bigger criticism with Buttigieg was like, okay, obviously, you're doing this for high rollers. What about the smaller events? And Pete was saying, like, I do those as well. And by the way, all of you are not going to reject any money at all. And going after Warren, that really, I actually thought his best line of the night was when he said, I am the only person here who's not a millionaire or a billionaire, basically telling the rest of the country, look, I can't even, if I wanted to self-finance my campaign, I can't. All these other people can. So, hey, let me go raise funds, even if I have to go to Napa and be in a place filled with a bunch of chandeliers and Swarovski crystals.
Liz, I thought it was interesting. Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, was interviewed about this. And he said, you know, he's been in that wine cave. And he said he thinks, you know, like 100 members of Democratic members of Congress have benefited from fundraisers there. And so I think, you know, you can sort of look at that two ways. One is, this is essential to how the Democratic Party competes. The other side is to sort of be depressed at how endemic this kind of fundraising is in the party.
Yeah, I always advocate depression in these circumstances, because it at least is an authentic and genuine reaction to the state of play, which is to participate in American politics, you have to be able to fundraise, and to fundraise, you have to rely on the good graces of extremely rich people in most circumstances. Andrew Yang made a good point about this. In order to be a patron of a political campaign, you have to have disposable income laying around, and that means that most people who involve themselves in fundraising for candidates are very rich, and we know that rich people have a certain set of class interests. That's just straightforwardly true. And then you have this alternative model, which Bernie has pioneered, which has worked out really well for him, of raising money strictly from small donors, lots and lots and lots of them. Now, it takes a big grassroots network to do that, and it's difficult and time-consuming. But Bernie has been able to pull it off. And so I think that's a good sign, and I think it throws into even greater relief what a morbid symptom it is that most Democrats, by contrast, still feel obligated to fundraise from the very rich.
Well, or I mean, I think this is a thing that gets missed in a lot of the conversation about why Elizabeth Warren made the shift that she did to stop doing high dollar fundraising, which is to say, I mean, being able to say I'm not beholden to these people is a good political advantage. But I think the even bigger advantage is that she doesn't have the time suck of spending so much time on the phone, so much time going to these fundraising events. That's more time that she can spend talking to voters. I think it's probably a reason that she was able to have that early surge that she had in Iowa. She talks about all the selfies that she takes. Partly she has the time to do that because she's not doing what other candidates are doing. But she, like Bernie, has this really activated grassroots base from which she's able to raise huge amounts in small dollar donations. So I don't know that that's necessarily replicable, especially for candidates for lower office and even for some presidential campaigns. But I think, you know, there is a reason that this has worked for her. Rich, did you have any thoughts on the wine cave before we move on?
Yeah, well, the problem Buttigieg have, obviously, is wine cave is kind of sticky, you know, because it's funny and memorable. But as discussed earlier, I think he clearly got the best of the argument and made Elizabeth Warren look like a complete hypocrite, given that she transferred a lot of this money over from her Senate campaign or Senate fund. And I don't think this kind of fundraising is corrupting in the way Elizabeth Warren portrays it. I think, Josh, you're right. It's enervating and grinding for the candidates. But there is, you know, you spend enough time with these kind of people who host these events and attend them, and you do tend to absorb the attitudes of a donor class, which you've seen certainly in the Republican Party, and you become used to not saying things that upset them. I mean, one reason I think Republicans have taken a very long time and still aren't there just to say wages should be higher, it's good for workers to be paid more, is because if you said that over the years in any of these kind of wine cave fundraisers, people would gasp and just think you're completely out of your mind. So, again, I think Buttigieg got the better part of the argument. But there is a downside to this sort of fundraising, which has been a rocket fuel of his campaign. You know, he right out of the gate, he established himself as this kind of young progressive who's going to aggressively take the fight to Donald Trump and Mike Pence and lit up this coastal elite donor community, but has been deft enough to be able to also pivot to the center here the last couple months.
One of the themes that kept popping up at this debate was how to talk about the economy at a time when a lot of Americans think that the economy is pretty good. And the main response from a lot of candidates was to basically deny the premise of the question. Here's Joe Biden.
Well, I don't think they really do like the economy. Go back and talk to the old neighbors in the middle-class neighborhood you grew up in. The middle class is getting killed. The middle class is getting crushed. And the working class has no way up as a consequence of that.
Now, this doesn't really align with the survey data, is my take on it. If you look at Gallup polling from last month, it finds that public sentiment about the economy actually is unusually positive right now. 65% of Americans say that now is a good time to find a quality job, which is close to the highest that rating has been since they started asking the question in 2002. If you ask people what's the most important problem facing the country, only 13% of them name an economic problem, which is close to an all-time low in the depths of the 2009 crisis. That was 86%. And if you ask people just, you know, what's the condition of the economy? 55% of them say excellent or good. And 55 doesn't sound like a world-beating figure, but it is unusually positive. It's better than at any time during the Bush administration or the Obama administration. In fact, the only time since 1992 that the public has rated the economy better than they do today was at the tail end of the Clinton administration, which was the best period for wage growth since the 1970s. So the economy is not the very best it could be, but I'm not sure that it makes sense in this context to say, eh, the economy is not so good. What do you make of that, Gustavo?
I want to know where those polls are coming from, because here in California, you talk to anyone, everyone complains about the economy, from college students to the middle class who's fleeing the state because they say California is taxing them too much and they don't have enough money to do so. I think what Biden and the other people are probably talking up to the crowd there in California, which happens to be the biggest state in the country, which of course also has its own booming economy, as Governor Newsom and so many of the of California's Democratic leadership will tell you. So I want to know who these people are who think the economy is as rosy as it's ever been. But the numbers are the numbers.
Well, so, I mean, one thing about that is that the responses to these questions are highly partisan, that when your party's in power, you're more likely to rate the economy as being good, all things equal. Now, you still see changes over time because it's not just partisanship. It also is affected by economic trends. But, Liz, I mean, one thing that strikes me is that, you know, the public as a whole has a generally pretty positive view on the economy, although, of course, there's a diversity of opinion. But people who are voting in this primary probably feel more negatively about the economy than people who are going to vote in the general election. So I guess you have to target a message to different groups of voters at different times.
Right. And I think that's pretty typical of movement from primary messaging to general messaging. It makes sense to speak to voters at this point who are probably more ill-contented with the economy than those in the general election. At the same time, we just have to make sure that that tailoring happens. I don't think that it's as easy to run on the economy being a problem this time as it was in 2016. And that was a message that was very strong in the Democratic primary in 2016. We have to get the economy sorted out. And I think that's going to be a much harder tack to take this time.
Yeah, Rich, I mean, the other thing that I think about when these candidates answer these questions is that how good the economy is not an objective fact, like what the unemployment rate is. It's a matter of opinion. And you can try to convince voters that the economy ought to be better than this and that they shouldn't feel so good about the economy in a way that you can't really just convince them that, you know, the GDP data are wrong or something like that. So I think, you know, I wonder whether any of this messaging from Democrats is there a vulnerability here for the president where Democrats can sell a message about, you know, yes, the economy is growing, but wage growth has not been as strong as it should be at this point in the cycle. Corporate profits are still, you know, an unusually large share of the economy, meaning that more of these returns from growth are going to owners instead of workers. It seems like there is a case for Democrats to make there so long as they acknowledge that, you know, that things are better than they were a few years ago.
Yeah, it's just that kind of nuance and relative subtlety. The subtlety is hard to pull off. And presidential politics, I think just the general tone which comes off, which is that, you know, it's nothing but rack and ruin in America, is one, factually inaccurate, and two, will strike people as tone deaf at best. But there are obviously parts of the country that aren't thriving. There are people who aren't thriving. We have these deaths of despair, which have suppressed life expectancy in our country, which is an astonishing thing. And just listening last night, you know, Bernie always says, I think it's like the last 45 years, basically workers in America have gained nothing. That's way too extreme. I don't think the numbers support that. But you can make a pretty good case that, you know, it gets complicated how you measure inflation and other things. But last 20 years hasn't been great for workers and has been closer to stagnation than it should have been. And that's a message that, you know, I was just thinking 4 or 5 years ago, I would have just rejected out of hand. Now I think there's a lot of truth to it.
This was not an all-white debate stage. Andrew Yang qualified for this debate, but there was a fair amount of discussion about the lack of any Black or Hispanic candidates on the stage because a few weren't able to get there. Kamala Harris had dropped out of the campaign. Cory Booker and Julian Castro did not meet the polling thresholds to qualify for this debate. And so the moderators asked some of the candidates, you know, what does this say about a party as diverse as the Democratic Party, where like 40% of the primary electorate is going to be non-white, that the leading candidates who are ahead in the polls and most of the people who are on this stage are white. And some of the candidates had some trouble with this question. Bernie Sanders in particular didn't really seem to want to answer it.
Senator Sanders, I do want to put the same question to you, Senator Sanders. What message do you think?
I will answer that question, but I wanted to get back to the issue of climate change for a moment because I do believe this is the existential issue.
Senator, with all respect, this question is about race. Can you answer the question as it was asked?
Because people of color, in fact, are going to be the people suffering most if we do not deal with climate change.
Gustavo, what'd you make of that exchange?
He actually had a good response to it, but seriously, true. Like, he can't answer the question with a straight face because you look up on stage, Andrew Yang's the only person of color in a debate for a party that says we are the party of inclusivity. We welcome everyone. The Republican Party is a party of angry white people. And here you have a bunch of angry white people on stage in a state that's majority minority, in a county that's even more majority minority, where Latinos are actually the majority of the population. The Democrats, I don't want to pick on Tom Steyer, but at least you could have put in Julian or Cory Booker. And of course, Kamala just recently dropped out. What would it have cost them? Now the Democrats are just opening themselves up to more criticism. And this being run by a Latino, Tom Perez, who's the president of the Democratic Party.
Isn't this the doing of voters in the Democratic primary? I mean, this electorate's going to be 40% non-white. If there were a surge of Hispanic support for Julian Castro, he would be on that debate stage, and he has been on several debate stages. I mean, isn't honoring the preferences of voters in the Democratic primary, including non-white voters in the Democratic primary, apparently these are the candidates they favor. Joe Biden has a big lead with black voters. Bernie, a lot of the polls show him having particular strength with Hispanics. I mean, I realize that Bernie Sanders and the other candidates can't say this, but isn't the response really sort of take that up with the voters?
A lot of young Latinos like Bernie. They call him Theo Bernie even. But what's going on, I think actually it's an indictment of the Democrats themselves that they have not been building up candidates in the long run. The last Latino Democrat who ran for president was somewhat significant was Bill Richardson, who ran back in 2008. It's something that Democrats have to realize and should be doing a better job. If they're going to say they're the party of inclusivity, especially when they try to cast the Republicans otherwise, then they have to work on that. Really quickly, in Orange County, for instance, a lot of Democrats in the congressional races, the big blue wave, they're mostly white folks, with the exception of Gil Cisneros. Meanwhile, the Republican Party, they're getting ready for 2020, and their cast of candidates are almost all Asian Americans. They've done a better job at diversity in Orange County, the Republicans, than Democrats have. Democrats should learn from the Republicans in Orange County.
Liz, this answer from Bernie seemed reminiscent of some of the criticisms that we've heard from him, especially from black progressive activists. And I think some of the factors that drove Hillary Clinton's overwhelming win among black voters over him in the 2016 primary, which is sort of such a focus on his class analysis, which is to say that, you know, all of us, you know, we all have aligned interests against the powerful elite, that it's sort of not sufficiently cognizant of the specific concerns of specific ethnic groups that may be different than just a class analysis.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's a decision that Bernie's campaign has made. They feel like the message that makes the most sense to him as a principle, and that the message they can be most consistent on, is that racism is a real and serious phenomenon. It's a real problem. I think Bernie's been pretty vocal about that. He uses the term. He has called Trump a racist and railed pretty hard against his racist presidency. And I think that at the same time, Bernie is pretty open about the fact that the manifestation of racism in a lot of cases is a class manifestation, that racist impacts are coming from poverty and the way that the economy acts on people of color. And so I think that's his message. He's been fairly consistent about it. There's a bit of trying to have it both ways, which I think you saw with this answer. And I think the answer is good. And I think it's true. And I think that all of the projections we've seen show that disasters from climate change would affect people of color most, because they're the people who are the poorest and they're people who are living in regions that are going to be most affected. At the same time, you know, it's obviously going to be unsatisfying to people who want to hear a more specific answer about the sort of ideological menace of racism.
I don't get this at all. I mean, the party is wide open. Anyone could run. A lot of people did. The criteria for these debates, totally transparent and totally objective. And the problem with Harris and Booker somewhat surprisingly for me, I thought maybe he'd get more traction. And Castro is largely a message one. Can anyone say, you know, in five words what the messages of any of those candidates are? And you don't have a message, you're probably going nowhere in presidential politics. Plus, Booker also fell prey, as Harris did at the outset, of kind of chasing Bernie Sanders down the track rather than being a little more nuanced and really realizing the party is not composed of fully of left-wingers on Twitter. So this just, I don't see this as an indictment of the Democratic Party or its voters or its donors at all. I think it's a failure of those candidates.
Finally, in the spirit of the season, I'd like to ask each one of you, is there someone else among these left, right, and center panelists that you would – you have two options. One, a panelist from whom you would ask forgiveness for something that maybe was said today or another time, or a panelist to whom you would like to give a gift. I'm going to start with you, Gustavo.
Oh, boy. I want to give Rich the gift of praise for his film critic, Armand White, who always makes me think and really, really is a sharp writer, although not Kyle Smith. So maybe I beg forgiveness for insulting Kyle Smith.
Rich Lowry.
Yeah, thanks for asking this totally impossible and stupid question, Josh, which I earlier tried to say was stupid, but I guess to no avail. I feel lucky. I just feel it's a gift every week to be on with my fellow left, right, and center panelists.
Aw. That's not really an answer to the question, but we appreciate it.
No, Liz Brunin, how about you? Most of the Democrats didn't answer it either.
So the resident Catholic on the panel, I would like forgiveness from everyone all the time for my bad takes and especially for the weird tweets that I consistently read out in Tweet of the Week.
So I want to ask forgiveness for every time we've had to edit any of you out. I apologize for that. We have a time slot, and sometimes parts of the show are better than other parts. But actually, I thought it was interesting that that Liz sought forgiveness there. And Liz, I was wondering what – obviously, this is precisely the question that Judy Woodruff asked toward the end of the debate. And a lot of people were remarking on how the – you know, Andrew Yang opens. At first, it looks totally stumped by the question. And I'm amazed he didn't say, I want to give everyone on the stage the gift of $1,000 a month. He never misses an opportunity to plug his the center of his agenda there. But then – he settled on, you know, I'm going to give everyone my book, which is like the most self-serving gift you can offer. And the two female candidates, both in one way or another, basically sought forgiveness for being too angry, which seemed like a remarkable commentary on the way that gender is perceived in this campaign.
Yeah, but Elizabeth Warren, she was when I was listening to this, I was thinking, even though I was totally stumped by your question, Josh, I was thinking, like, what would I say? Or what was the most political answer to this? It would be, I'm sorry I care too much. And that was basically Elizabeth Warren's answer, right? She gets a little angry and worked up because she cares so much because of these stories that she hears in her selfie lines.
Well, so I think that was the nature of Warren's answer. It didn't feel to me like the nature of Amy Klobuchar's answer, who seemed more sincere about that, you know, almost acknowledging that these news stories about her and her staff have been a challenge for her campaign and seemed like, you know, trying to be like, you know, well, you know, this is I'm sorry if I made any of you angry, but, you know, I think these issues are important kind of thing. I don't know, Liz, what did you make of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's a stupid question. Like Rich said, they always throw in a stupid question. But it's a stupid question for a very specific reason. And that is, if somebody really wants forgiveness from someone else, they'll ask in private. So asking someone to ask for forgiveness in a public forum is asking them to come up with something that they, you know, feel bad about but not too bad about, that they're willing to be vulnerable about but not too vulnerable about. So you know, you were destined to get these kind of tossed off answers about caring too much or being too dedicated to the cause. I was surprised nobody turned it into an opportunity for a joke, which is what I would have done. But I think that, you know, there is something to the fact that both of the women on stage went for the forgiveness and all of the men either kind of blew the question off altogether, which is totally respectable, or spoke of, you know, giving the gift of their candidacy or something. I think that women, you know, tend to feel a lot more pressure about the things they're doing wrong, especially when they're doing ambitious things. And so that was probably the root cause of that pattern.
Oh, we've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Gustavo Arellano, what's on your mind?
In 2019, over 3,000 reporters across the United States lost their jobs. Journalism, of course, is in crisis. So for this Christmas, instead of ordering something on Amazon, your Sonos speaker, whatever, subscribe to Journalism. There's five great publications, news organizations right here on Left, Right, and Center. New York Magazine, National Review, New York Times, My LA Times, and, of course, KCRW. Subscribe to those publications and give a donation to KCRW.
Liz Brunig, what's your rant?
So I've been hearing quite a few people on the right. I always watch right-wing news shows to get a sense of what's going on the other side of the ideological spectrum. Talk about how, due to Donald Trump, we're all saying Merry Christmas again. And my question is, why did you ever stop? I'm a big Christmas enthusiast, and I'm a Christmas enthusiast and an open and vocal Christian on the left, where it's not always easy, especially not as easy as it is on the right. And I never felt like I shouldn't be saying Merry Christmas. I say Merry Christmas when I feel like it, when we're celebrating, and for no reason other than wishing people a happy and joyous season. So if you stop saying Merry Christmas because department store clerks weren't saying it to you, that's a you problem. It's not a political problem, and I doubt Donald Trump has done anything to solve it.
Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
The Supreme Court has let stand one of the most preposterous court decisions in a long time, a ruling by the Ninth Circuit that says ordinances against camping in public are a supposed violation of the Eighth Amendment's prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment. This completely outlandish ruling makes it harder for Western jurisdictions overwhelmed by a crisis of homelessness to discourage the homeless encampments that are a hideous blight and a threat to public order and health.
For my rant, UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson has his new majority government, and one thing that may be a surprising priority for that government is encouraging production of new housing. They're even talking about overriding local rules on development, letting people build two more stories than is currently allowed. It's a good idea, and it reflects a fundamental problem. Left to their own devices, local jurisdictions with strong job growth will never permit enough housing. Not only do people hate change in their neighborhoods, it's always fiscally better for a town or a city or county to collect taxes on new office buildings or new retail without having to provide services to a bunch of pesky new residents who will live in new houses. But people have to live somewhere, and the government needs to make sure enough houses can be built to meet demand. There are significant lessons here for California. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Liz Brunig, and Gustavo Arellano. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director today is Kat Yore. PJ Shahamat is our production assistant. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.